Hi, once again, welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We talk automotive maintenance and repair this afternoon with Gordon Fricke, owner and operator of Barber & Fricke Automotive Incorporated, an independent repair, auto body, towing, and used car facility in Hoosick Falls, New York. Get your calls in early. It is now the driving season. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. You can also post your comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website. It's WAMC.org/VoxPop. Or you can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, Facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Or you can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop or email us at VoxPop@WAMC.org. All those things work, but we need your calls to make the program work. 1-800-348-2551 is the phone number. Gordon Fricke, welcome back.
Thank you, Ray. How are you today?
Good. I mean, it is really now fully driving season, vacation time, and must be a busy time for you.
Yeah, this is finally full-on summer. And it. When I drove in today, I was just telling you the thermometer or the outside reading was 99 degrees, and it stayed there from Henry Johnson Boulevard all the way up Central Ave. It's really that hot.
Yeah. And so do we need to take extra precautions at this time?
Well, these temperatures they challenge your vehicle's cooling system, mm-hmm. the air conditioning system. This heat has an effect on a lot of different things. And it doesn't always bring about problems right away. It may take a few days. But this is when you want to make sure your cooling system is good. And your air conditioner, if you're even a half a pound low on refrigerant, you may not have noticed any decrease in your car's ability to cool you, mm-hmm. but this little spree of weather is bringing it about.
Yeah, and I assume you're doing a lot of recharges right about now at the shop.
You know, not off the chart, but we are doing them.
Yeah. Yep. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke, our guest. David in Woodstock, you're first. Hello, David. Hang on. Zach, the engineer, have you potted him up? I see. Let's try it again. No? Okay. Well, David, I suspect you're hearing me, but we're not hearing you. So I'll tell you what. We will have you call back at another time, and then it'll work, right?
It might be the heat, Ray.
You think it's the heat?
It's very everything. You blame everything on the heat now.
Right. Now, I mean, you know, obviously you think about the cooling systems. You think about the air conditioning. But the heat, can it play any role in just mechanical parts?
Yeah, sure it does. Belts, under hood temperatures, even without scorching outside temperatures, get extremely hot.
Yeah.
I mean, you can have things under the hood on even normal days, 150, 160 degrees plus. The heat that the engine is giving off itself, if you were to put a scanning thermometer on the outside of the engine,
yeah.
you'd be seeing 200, 230, 240, some places even hotter than that.
Yeah.
And that's all got to go somewhere. So it radiates out and everything around it gets hot. So it puts a lot of pressure on things.
How often should one flush and replace the coolant in a car, or does it vary from car to car?
You know, that's something that used to have to happen much more frequently. Coolants have gotten better along with everything else. The quality of the cast iron that the engine is made of, and there's a lot of engines that are all aluminum, but there's still a lot of cast iron blocks with aluminum heads.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the rust comes from. When you see coolant turning brown and rusty,
yeah.
it's from the cast iron inside the engine. And the coolant's ability to ward off corrosion has an effect on that.
Okay.
So when it gets older and more tired, and maybe it's been watered down from various leaks and fill-ups, and maybe
sure.
it didn't get the right mixture put in it, now it's taking on that rust. And that can raise havoc with a lot of things. It can plug up passages. The cooling system, believe it or not, can also generate a little current of electricity. It becomes a miniature battery.
Oh, really?
Yep. So the acidity in the coolant has to get back to a good pH level so you're not electrocuting everything inside.
Interesting. Well, I had mine done, and then I found out later they showed it to me, and they said it's pretty bad, pretty dirty and what have you, and thin. And
did they show you a sample of the liquid, or did they put
one
of those test strips in
there? Well, I think they did both. They did both. The test strips can be bogus.
The test strips are okay, but they need to be fairly fresh, because if they sit too long in humidity, if they're not sealed up properly, you'll get a false reading.
Oh, interesting.
But they are very accurate. They do work.
Well, it's not a bad idea to do it anyway.
Not at all.
All right. And remember, if you're going to check your coolant, never do it while the engine is hot. That's can be a dangerous
thing.
Good
idea.
Well, yeah. David in Woodstock, are you there now? Hello, testing. David in Woodstock. Zach the engineer, are we patched through proper? Ha, ha, ha.
It's Zach the engineer.
It's now you're there, David.
Okay, great. So this is a comment on the last show, in which you spoke about using lower octane than recommended by the manufacturer. And I want to give you my experience. I have an 05 Mini Cooper, the regular, not the supercharged. The book calls for 91 octane. After a number of years of, doing 91 or an 89, I went to the dealer and said, do I really need this? And he said, nah, just use 87. The only time you really need 91 is on a hot day like today, when you're pulling a lot of air conditioning and you're doing some high-speed driving. And I don't even use, I never use anything but 87. Now, the car is 282,000 miles on it. And so I consider that to be, it works. And I just wanted to pass that on to you that, I would say, try it. And maybe with a very high performance car, you can't get away with it. But the Mini Cooper, while it's a great car and I love it, it's, doesn't seem to need anything but 87.
Yeah, that's a great comment. And I've had this question, we've had that question many, many times. And modern cars, and when I'm saying modern, I mean, I don't even mean, you're talking at least 10, 15, some cars even 20 years ago, began having a device called a knock sensor. And it's a little listening device that bolts to the engine, and it listens for the pinging or detonation sounds that poor or low octane gas can cause. And that detonation can be very dangerous to the engine if it continues for too long a period of time. Now that most all cars have these knock sensors, when that detonation begins, it starts to back your ignition timing off to the point where it stops hearing the detonation. So no engine damage will occur. You may get some reduced engine power, and if you're running a lower octane fuel consistently than the engine wants, and the knock system is retarding the timing over a long period of time, you'll get some reduced fuel economy. So that brings us back to the question of, if you went to 91 octane, for example, which I think your Mini calls for, over the long haul, would the slight improvement in economy offset the reduction that you're, or the less price you're paying for the 87? And I don't know. You'd have to do some serious number crunching. But great comment, and it's true.
All right.
And I've tracked the gas mileage since I bought the car. Every time I fill up, I reset my average fuel economy. And I would say that there's no fall off in mileage. The biggest factor in gas mileage is my tires. How grippy they are, how much flex they have in them.
And
the harder the tire, the better the gas mileage, and the softer the tire, the worse.
Yep, true. But, you're right on.
David, thanks a lot for the call.
Have a great day.
Boy, I remember back in the old days, 70s, late 70s, early 80s, pings were fairly common.
Oh, yeah. They were. In fact, I can remember I worked for a tire shop when I was a teenager, and this was in the 70s, and the emission controls were being slammed on vehicles, pretty much pushed by the government.
Yeah.
Car manufacturers weren't ready for these things, so a lot of it was hit and miss. And I can remember these Ford pickup trucks rattling and pinging to the point where you thought the pistons were going to fly out of the hood.
Yep.
It was just intense. And it did do damage back then. It would break pistons, and it was a very costly affair.
We had some Chevy Impalas late 70s, and the ping was quite pronounced, but I think they lasted a pretty long time.
You don't hear that anymore.
No,
cars don't ping.
No, you don't. John in Pittsfield, you're next. John.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I have a machine that goes ping also.
Ha ha ha, a little Monty Python reference. Well done.
Thank you. I have an 02 Volkswagen Beetle with a 2-liter, and it's got just over 100,000 miles. And shortly after starting it, it starts to do this pinging, ticking sound that also corresponds with how the RPMs go up and down. So I'm just curious what you think that might be before I take it to a shop.
Is it a rhythmic clatter? In other words, if the engine speeds up, this noise also increases in frequency, and if you let it idle, that sound slows down?
Yes.
What you could be hearing is valve lifter noise.
Okay.
Has this been going on for a long time, or is this a recent thing?
Actually, it's been going on for maybe 3 months.
How often do you have the oil changed?
I get it done every 5,000, and I top it off in between.
Okay. Do you notice any difference after a fresh oil change? Does this calm down after you've driven in a few days?
No, it hasn't. I mean, performance hasn't been affected or gas mileage or anything. It's just
the noise. Well,
right.
Without me, of course, hearing it, there's another problem that mimics that type of valve noise, but it's not common on your vehicle. But if you have a leaking exhaust manifold gasket because of either broken studs or bolts or a gasket that's bad, you'll get a very similar sound. And generally that in the early stages will quiet down after the engine warms up because the manifold has expanded and sealed up the leak temporarily. So there's two possibilities, and of course there could be other things that it might end up being, but I think it'd be a good idea to get it checked out. And do you say it goes away when it's warmed up?
No, I mean it goes away sometimes, but not too often. I did go over a curb this past winter and hit the underside, so maybe I did bust something in the exhaust.
Yeah, usually that would not cause the manifold leak. You may have damaged something under there, but as long as this sound is going to be obvious to the shop when you bring it, they'll be able to tell you what it is.
Okay, right. Great. And I have one other thing.
Right, very quickly, I'm going to break here. Go ahead.
Yeah, if my car's been sitting for a couple of days and the weather's been rainy, it sputters quite a bit. Mm-hmm. The check engine light will come on, and it's not until the engine gets warm and I get the RPMs up will it stop doing that.
Yeah, I'll give you the quick answer, because you probably need possibly an ignition coil and or spark plug wires. Very, very common on your engine.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much.
Yep, John, thank you. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Gordon Fricke is our guest. It's Automotive Repair and Maintenance. 800-348-2551. Get in now. More calls coming up.
Comes from the Henyon Bakery, Amherst. Since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. Washington County Tourism, presenting their outdoor concert series weekdays and weekends throughout the county, including Cambridge, Greenwich, Granville, and Whitehall. WashingtonNYCounty.com. Foresight Land Services, Pittsfield, Massachusetts, for over 45 years offering civil engineering, land surveying, land planning, and environmental permitting to private and municipal clients in the Berkshires and Eastern New York. ForesightLand.com. And Craft Producers, presenting the Southern Vermont Art and Craft Festival at Camelot Village in Bennington, a juried craft show with music, food, and kids' activities. August 2nd through the 4th, CraftProducers.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC, 1-800-348-2551 is our number. Gordon Fricke is our guest. And from Facebook, Patrick O'Fish asks this question for you, Gordon. My 2001 Toyota Camry LE, it's four-cylinder automatic, keeps pumping in warm air. Days like today are unbearable. Anytime it's over 70 outside, my car becomes an oven inside. If I turn on the defroster, it's part of the AC system, the vents on the passenger side kick out warmish air while the driver's side kicks out normal, cool, dry air. The AC works, but since the problem started, the incoming hot air dilutes the AC chilled air. I'm guessing there's a ventilation door louver, I like to say louver, stuck open somewhere. Question, what are the possible problems and fixes? Is there a computer control in Toyotas to reboot these ventilation louvers? If not, what kind of mechanic should work on this, general or AC specialist? And what is a reasonable price to be charged for this? By the way, he says, this hot air incursion happens even when the fan is off and regardless of the temperature setting.
Yeah, I think he's kind of figuring things out. There is a what's called a blend door.
Okay.
And that blend door does just what it says. It blends warm air from the heater core with cool air from the AC evaporator.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on the desired temperature that you set it at, whether it's digital or if it's just a manual set, that blend door kind of balances things out. If you want it as cold as it can be, it'll shut that door and turn the hot air portion completely off. If it's 10 below zero, the door does the opposite and shuts off all cool air and gives you full heat.
Yeah.
I've got a feeling his blend door is either stuck or just doesn't go full range. So he doesn't need to necessarily go to an AC specialist.
Mm-hmm.
A general repair shop can look into that system. And what they're going to need to do is gain access to that blend door, which that can be sometimes a serious chore, depending on the layout of the system.
So in other words, you have to take a lot of things out?
Sometimes.
So that's an hourly right there.
Yeah. Some cars are really easy, and that blend door actuator is what it's called. Some cars are really easy to get at. And if it's an easy one, you simply remove it, and then you work that flap by hand and see if it'll go full hot, full cold.
Now, you know, he mentions, thank you, Ian Pickus, our producer, came in with another one from social media. He mentions here, Patrick O'Fish mentions that the passenger side kicks out warmish air, but the driver's side kicking out cold air.
Yeah, and, you know, that car, tell me the car again,
2001
right?
Toyota Camry LE.
I don't think that has separate passenger and driver's side temperature controls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of cars do. Your car probably does.
It does. It does. There's a knob over there.
Yeah.
I never knew what it.
And you can
now. You told me what it is. That's great.
Like my wife doesn't want it cold, so her side's on like 78. Mine's on like 68.
Yeah.
But I don't think you can do that on his car. It's probably a distribution issue still.
Okay.
So that's where I would go with it.
All right. Before we get back to the phones at 800-348-2551, here's another one from Alicia. Somewhere in the 845. I too have a 2010 Mini Cooper Clubman. However, I do experience the ping when I use 87 octane, but I can use 89 octane, which works fine, and I get an average of 35.8 miles per gallon.
Interesting.
So Alicia gets the ping, and our first caller of the day, or second caller, didn't get the ping.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Brian in Duanesburg, you're on.
Yes, hello. Thank you. Gordon, I'm calling on your expertise because I know you know about Audis. I have two Audis, an 02 A6 Avant with a 3.0 and a 02 TT with a 1.8 turbo. And all the research I've done, I get nothing but conflicts about what kind of oil to use. Right now I'm using a 5. I do my own changes. I'm using a good quality filter and 5W30 synthetic. What's your view?
Sure. Those are a couple of nice cars. And
thank you.
Audi has changed their oil specifications, and they do this. It's an ongoing thing. They decide that there's better oils, different viscosities, and they just kind of change up the specs as things go along. So,
they do with the timing belt.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, hopefully yours doesn't break before they decide that you got to change it sooner than they said. But
well, I did one, and I'm going to do the other.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very important to do those right on time, just to be on the safe side. But the oil, the latest spec that Volkswagen and Audi has published is a 5W40, and the preferred oil. And you do not have to necessarily use this, but they're leaning towards Castrol. And I stocked the Castrol for all of those cars, and it was originally called Syntec, but it is their full synthetic oil, and it has all VW Audi's current specifications.
Actually, it's the Syntec that I've been using.
Yeah,
that's 5.30, but I'll go up to 5.40.
It's very good oil, and it's not horribly priced. It's a lot. I think it's most generally less than like the mobile ones that have always been quite high. Your other car, the TT, that's a turbocharged engine. Even more important to use the right oil and change it at very good intervals to prevent future sludging and oil passage issues and oil sump pickup problems. So it's not worth skimping on oil, that's for sure.
Okay, Brian, thanks a lot for the call. Now, you and I have been through this many times, but synthetic oil is better. Why?
It seems to be more capable of handling contamination,
mm-hmm.
keeping it in suspension. The viscosity flexibility is better. It just has better properties than plain old conventional motor oil. And again, it's all about the additives and the blending, because it still starts out as base crude oil.
So it starts with...
It starts out as oil, but you have way more synthetic components, man-made components blended into it.
I see.
So, and some have much greater than others. Some are called plain old synthetic blends. Others are called full synthetic. But it still starts out with some oil in there.
Interesting. Let's go back to the phones at 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke is our guest. Diane in New Salem is on. Diane.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I have a Subaru 2010. I'm not having any problems with it. My question, I hope, isn't redundant. I didn't listen to the part of the show that started at
2 o'clock.
How long should I go between oil changes when I'm only putting about 3,500 miles on in a year?
Wow, that's going to
so
be
how much time basically?
Yeah, that's okay.
A year.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, the general talk is if you're putting so few miles on your car like you are,
mm-hmm.
to at least do it once a year.
Oh,
because
so that is sufficient.
Yeah. Now, the other factor, of course, is the fact that we live in an area where there's winters and there's rapid temperature changes. There's a lot of moisture in the air.
Yeah.
On a car that gets so little use, it's good to maybe after 6 months or so have somebody check the oil and look at the condition of it. If it's getting extremely dark, that means a lot of contamination is suspended in the oil. And that's what the oil does. That's why it gets dark, because it's grabbing up combustion byproducts and stuff like that holding it there till you dump it out.
Okay.
So I would say at least once a year, and maybe sooner if it's not looking clean.
Okay.
Okay.
Diane, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. 800-348-2551. It's Vox Pop. Gordon Fricke is here. Ralph in Bethlehem. Ralph, you're on.
Hi, I've got a couple quick questions. Thanks for taking my call. These are more just in terms of your opinion on a couple of things. I drive a 1997 Mercury Tracer station wagon. My wife and I got it from free about a year and a half ago from a family member who was in Florida and didn't need the car. We just had to pay to ship it up here. We got it with about 19,000 miles, and wouldn't you know, within a couple of months, the only thing wrong with it, a couple months after we got it, the odometer stopped working, and it stopped at 20,300, and I'm guessing we're up around 30,000 now. But the first question I had is, my wife and I have had this discussion, to what extent, in your opinion, do we have a new car, given its mileage, and to what extent do we have an old car, given its year? Second quick question I had has to do with the service engine light. We've driven a lot of cars before. I'm of the opinion that service engine lights like to go on sometimes just because they want to shine and be pretty. In your experience, I'm at about 90-10. I think 90% of the time the service engine light goes on because it just has got a mind of its own, or there's a short or something. I'm just wondering what kind of a ratio you would say for service engine lights going on. I'll hang up and I'll just listen to your response, but thanks very much.
Great questions, Ralph. Thank you. Go ahead.
So the first question was time versus mileage,
yes.
Basically. Yeah, and that's a good one, because you can have a car that is old but extremely low mileage and be in horrible condition. You can have a car that has really big miles and it's not that old and have it be in fantastic condition. Because this car came from Florida, that's a definitely good head start.
Right. So, California would be good. Florida would be good.
Any non-rusting states.
Yeah.
In that case, this car probably is in nice condition. There are some maintenances, though, that are time sensitive, and I believe that particular car has a timing belt, and that belt is going to get really old.
Even without the mileage?
Yes, because that belt has lived since 1997 on that car. It's been under tension that whole time. And even though there's no sunlight in there, it's subject to the environment, some ozone and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, and I think that car is a timing belt driven engine. And I could be wrong, but if it is, that's something that definitely wants to get looked at.
Okay.
And the second question was the check engine light. That's also almost an epidemic. We see that on so many cars now. They generally don't come on for no reason at all, and the reasons they come on can be varied. It can be anything from a slightly leaking gas cap to any hoses or lines from the cap to the engine, but it can be tied into sensors. So that's.
Can you check your own codes in the 97 Mercury?
Yeah, if you had a code reader.
Oh, you need a code reader.
Yeah, if you can't dial it up like you can
on the dash
on your car.
Yeah,
you know,
which
you
is
can
so
do,
helpful.
You can do a lot of stuff in that car
that's
that
so
most
cool.
people can't.
Yeah.
So.
Well, yeah, and pay for the premium gas.
That's right.
Which is the trade-off. All right, let's go to Larry in Hatfield, Mass. Larry, you're on.
Hi, Gordon. I've got a, I think it's an 07 or 06, I don't remember, Toyota Avalon. And at around 99,000 miles, the dashboard lit up with check engine and anti-lock and everything went on. And it turns out it was an ignition cylinder went bad. And needless to say, it was one of them that's basically under the firewall. And it was quite a job, but it was covered under extended warranty to 100,000 miles. Well, at 105,000, another one went bad in the same place. It cost me a lot of money, and now I have 120,000, and I've already replaced a third one. Now, at least they put off the last time they put another new one in the back, or they switched them. But what's going on here? This is a really nice car, and I'm getting killed with these regular repairs on the ignition coils.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not an uncommon failure in a lot of cars. The ignition coils nowadays are sitting basically on top of the spark plugs. So if you have a six-cylinder engine, you have six coils, where not that long ago you had one coil, and that supplied the spark to the whole engine.
Yeah.
And it was distributed by the distributor. So now these coils are sitting on the engine, very, very hot region. They're right in the middle of the cylinder head, and they don't like the heat. And days like this can really aggravate them. There's nothing you can do. As long as you've had the spark plugs changed when they were supposed to, because a worn-out spark plug with a super wide gap puts a big strain on the ignition coil. So you'll have coil failures on high-mileage, worn-out spark plugs where you may not get them on plugs that are new or replaced when they should.
Hmm.
So you want to make sure your spark plugs have been changed in that car, and that's about all you can do other than hope that the other coils don't fail.
Now, are the back spark plugs going to be as difficult to change as the coils were?
Yeah, because the plugs are under the coils. You have to take the coil off first to get to the spark plug.
But if I went to a mechanic, it would be hundreds of dollars to change those three plugs.
Really?
They're in a bad spot.
In the old days, you just replaced the spark plugs.
Yeah.
It was easy.
Yeah.
You can't get to them. I mean, I couldn't do it. There's all kinds of, aside from all the cowling and everything, it's under like the lip of the hood.
Yeah. I know that some people with certain cars, particularly V6s like yours that are transversely mounted, cannot believe what it costs to change the plugs. And I know what it takes to change them. I'm telling you, I have said my share of swearing changing plugs on cars like that. It is no fun whatsoever.
Well, Larry, good luck with that. Back in the day, you just did it yourself. Plugs is something even an incompetent car person like myself could do.
Spark plugs back in the day were fun to change.
Yeah.
And everybody changed them. You changed them more often than you needed to.
Now, that's a great question, and I think we'll take a break here in a moment or two, but, you know, how often, and I guess it must vary from car to car or type of car, to type of car. But how often do you change a spark plug? Yeah. That's something you don't think about much anymore.
A lot of the manufacturers went to very high-quality spark plugs that would last, in some cases, 100,000 miles. Some intervals are even higher. And they will do it. The fear is, though, if they stay in the engine that long and you have trouble removing them, you may strip threads and then be in a real serious predicament.
Is that where the swearing comes in?
More than that, yeah. Injured knuckles.
Oh.
Yeah, bad news.
Don't you have a low-paid employee who can do that for you?
I'm the guy.
Oh, you're the guy. Yeah. I see. All right, we're going to take a short break here. 800-348-2551. A couple more from the social media and more of your calls on Vox Pop with Gordon Fricke.
Support comes from the Preservation League of New York State, Albany, New York, protecting New York's historic buildings, districts, and landscapes since 1974. PreserveNYS.org. The Sterling and Francine Clark Art Institute in Williamstown, Massachusetts, presenting Winslow Homer, Making Art, Making History, clarkart.edu. Washington County Tourism, presenting their outdoor concert series weekdays and weekends throughout the county, including Cambridge, Greenwich, Granville, and Whitehall, washingtonnycounty.com. And the Berkshire Choral Festival, performing Lauridsen and Vaughn Williams, Saturday at 7:30 p.m., Berkshire School, Sheffield, Massachusetts, choralfest.org.
Automotive maintenance and repair today on Vox Pop. Gordon Fricke, our regular guest on these shows, and the number to call is 800-348-2551. All right, Gordon, we've got a couple here. One's an email to voxpop@wamc.org. This is from Alex. I have a 2003 Honda Civic with 100,000 miles on it. I believe that it has a timing belt rather than a chain. When should it be changed? Are there other repairs, maintenance, that it makes sense to do at the same time? And here's the big question. How much should it cost?
Well, it's a great question because that car, what is it, an 03, Ray?
It's an 03 Honda Civic with 100,000 miles on it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that is still a timing belt engine.
Okay.
And Honda's interval for those engines, I believe, was at 105,000 miles.
So he's getting there.
He's really there.
Okay.
Definitely needs to be done. And with a Honda in particular, Honda was one of the first ones to highly recommend or even advise of changing the water pump at the same time because it's driven by the timing belt. What I generally do is I buy these component kits and you get all the moving parts in a box and you change them all, including the tensioner. So when you're done with it, it's as if it rolled out of this factory and you're back to square one with hopefully no worries of worn out rollers or idler wheels or things like that.
I guess it makes sense. I mean, if you're going to do the timing belt, you might as well
do all the stuff because you don't want to go back there a year later and find out the hard way that one of those rollers wore out or broke, the timing belt broke, the pistons hit the valves,
and goodbye.
And the shop says, yeah, we can fix it. It's about $4,000.
Yeah, okay, good point. Julie from Facebook asks, my brakes are getting old. My mechanic showed me how a couple of the caliper pistons are very hard to reset during repadding, and brake pads were wearing down prematurely. Is it recommended that calipers be replaced after a certain number of miles driven because they will eventually stick?
For the most part, the answer is yes. And some vehicles almost never need calipers, and others a lot of the time do. But if she's having caliper sticking issues...
What is a caliper?
The caliper is the device that actually squeezes the brake pads against the disc.
Okay.
Picture your bicycle.
Sure.
You pull the grip and those two things clamp on the wheel?
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of what's happening with your car, but not mechanically. And the caliper is the part that does the squeezing.
Okay.
And if they stick, your brakes won't fully release. They could really get hot and smoke. Or if they're just sticking a little bit, they'll wear out way faster than they should have.
Okay.
So the answer to her is yes, you got
to
do them.
Fair enough. Back to the phones we go. Carol in New Paltz, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Hi, my name is Carol, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We bought a 2004 Buick Century about a year ago for our son. And he was mostly driving during the day. But I was driving at night one time, and the headlights would just go out. So I'd pull over to the side immediately. Luckily, there was a side to pull over on. And I turned off the car, turned back on the car, and the lights were on. That happened about four or five more times in the same ride where the lights would go off, I'd pull over. But each time, it seemed that the time got shorter where the lights would turn off by themselves. Now, we took it to a Buick dealer, left it there for about a week where they were working. They were looking to see what was wrong, couldn't find anything. Brought it to our local mechanic, couldn't find anything. And I wonder if you have any suggestions. It happened to me one other time when I drove it at night. It hasn't happened to my son or my husband, anybody else.
Okay, this car, I assume, has auto headlights. They turn on when it gets dark or dusky.
I believe so, but to tell you the truth, we haven't been driving it at night at all for a long time.
Well, here's what I'm getting at. I think that car most definitely has that type of a headlight that comes on automatically, but there's also on your headlight switch, you can also turn the lights on regardless of the outside light. So what I would do first is either the next time you drive it, I would wait till they failed. And just don't be going in a turn at 90 miles an hour. But if they fail, hit the switch and manually turn them on. And if they immediately come on, and you can reproduce that a couple of times, it has to do with your auto on light system. There's a light sensor in the dashboard. The other thing is, if they go out, dim them. Pull the dimmer to go from high to low to high to low. Wiggle that switch around. Because we've had a fair share of those light switch dimmer assemblies failing on cars like yours. So that's
how old is that car?
It was a 2004.
Yeah. That's right in the range where we're seeing stuff like that happening.
All right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much,
Carol. Thanks a lot. I had a car a few years ago and couldn't get the headlight. Bought it for a song. Couldn't get the headlights to work, and for the life of me, turned out that the fuse box had terrible corrosion.
Yeah.
And it was just the corrosion on that particular fuse needed to be wiped away.
That happens.
Next thing you know, bam, lights on.
Nice. Good find.
Got a good cheap car that way. Dale and Beacon, you're on. Dale.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
I have a follow-up air conditioning question. When you explained the problem to the other person, something went off in my mind because I'm having a problem with my Volkswagen Vanagon. It's an 89, and the compressor works. They recharged it with the Freon. Everything seems to be okay, only it doesn't get cold. And the mechanic thinks it might be a blockage somewhere. And I heard you tell that other person it was that door. What did you call it again?
Yeah, that's called a blend door.
Would I have that on my car also?
No, your Vanagon uses an older system that you varied the heat by a hot water valve, basically. You turn the hot water flow on and off. So that system is not elaborate enough on that vehicle. And the air conditioning system on that is not as integrated as a lot of vehicles are. In fact, there were Vanagons that didn't have air to begin with, so it was an option. So I think you got just something going on plain with the air conditioning system. What it could be, other than making sure the charge of the refrigerant is at the absolute correct amount. Other than that, they got to check for other things.
So a condenser or
stuff like that.
Well, that seems to be okay. He said he's almost sure it's a problem. It's a blockage. And I looked in the manual in the book, and there's only two hoses going to the compressor unit.
Right.
And I said, could it be in these two hoses? Because they don't show the diagram or the schematic for the hoses going all around.
Well, that's all. The Vanagon is the air conditioning system is very long. The engine's in the back, and the air conditioning is up front. So there's a lot of plumbing in there.
Okay.
Yeah.
What would be a good way to check that? Should he run something like smoke with a dye in it or something to see if it gets through?
Usually,
how would you check that?
Well, it could be very extensive. You may, I don't know if you want
it. With a T or with a P?
Actually, that's almost the same word, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Thermal expansion valve is the place that can get blocked and or the receiver dryer / filter. But if he does air, it's no different than any other car. It's just set up a little differently.
A little differently. So he should look at the expansion valve and the, what was that other one?
And the receiver dryer.
Receiver dryer.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Dale, thank you for the call. It's Gordon Fricke today, 1-800-348-2551. Laura Lee in Skodak Landing, you're next.
Hi, can you hear me?
Sure.
Okay, now I'm in downtown Albany with a headset and a really hot car. I have a Hyundai Accent 2003, and it's a wonderful car. I adore it, but in the last year I have put $2,000 into it with an oil pan and a steering wheel cable and things that I don't even know the name of. I already have a new clutch. Anyway, I'm wondering, is there a way that I can give it, like, a physical exam to find out whether it's worth keeping for another 2 or 3 years? It's just a great little car, and I love it, but, like, right now, should I replace the compressor for the air conditioning? Years ago, I heard something about a compression check. Would that be something that's relevant?
Well, what you can do is make an appointment with your repair shop to just give the car a thorough check over, and trying to spot future problems. And that sometimes is difficult to do. But there's a lot of things that we can look at a car that might predict the future. Condition of, take the oil cap off, see if it's sludged up under there. Look at the, is yours a manual or an automatic transmission?
It's a manual.
Okay, so the automatic is not an issue there. They're going to shake the wheels, they're going to check the wheel bearings, they're going to look at steering and suspension, check struts for leakage. You know, there's a lot of stuff that can be looked at. And they may say, man, we got a giant list of stuff that this car is on the brink of needing, and that'll push you into making your decision. Or they'll say, at the moment, everything looks real good. So I would definitely have that done.
Great idea.
Okay. At the moment, they say you've replaced almost everything.
There's always more to go.
That's right.
Okay.
If all else fails, replace the driver.
Guys.
Laura Lee,
thanks
a lot for the call. Let's go to Judy in Lake Hill. Judy.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Good, how are you?
Good.
Pretty good, a little hot here, but other than that, doing all right. I have a question about replacing my car. I have an older Subaru, I think it's a 97, and I'm up at 200,000 miles, and I'm in the market to get another car, and I have some things that I need. I need it to be a station wagon of some sort because I have paintings and dogs that I need to haul around, and I need it to be a little more comfortable than the Subaru because when I ride anywhere of any distance, my back is tired and you feel all the bumps and everything. So I'm looking at something that I hope it's not just pure lust, and I wanted to see what you thought. I really like the way the Jettas look and their wagons, and they seem safer and the ride seems better than my car. But I'm also looking to get better gas mileage than my 26 to 28 miles a gallon.
Okay.
Yep, good question. Sorry, are you interested in buying new?
Well, I have a friend who bought a new Hyundai a week or two ago, and it's an incredible deal. And I started adding up the difference between 40 miles a gallon and 20 miles a gallon, and she's saving, based on 10,000 miles, about $1,600 a year just in gas.
Is she really getting that kind of mileage?
Well, that's what she said.
Okay, because
I don't really know, and I don't really want a Hyundai, but I would like to improve my gas mileage.
I have a friend that's on his second Jetta wagon, and he's had extremely good luck. The first one went, I got to believe, 200,000 miles, and it was a Jetta wagon. His was a 5-speed manual. He loved it so much, he bought a brand-new one, also with a 5-speed manual, and getting very good mileage, and it does everything that you're looking for in a car, and the price is very, very reasonable. Volkswagen lowered a lot of prices, so that's definitely a contender for you.
Oh, great.
Volvo wagons are very nice.
Mm-hmm.
They're more money. The XC70s, for example, they're all-wheel drive, so you're going to get that all-wheel drive thing like your Subaru has.
Mm-hmm.
You won't get the mileage because they're bigger and heavier. So if you're looking to improve your gas mileage, there are very few wagons out there.
Yeah, well, 1991 Buick Roadmaster wagon.
That's a classic.
That would be
that's
good.
That's a nice car.
Plenty of room for dogs and paintings in that thing.
Yeah, gas mileage wasn't hideous either for a car that size.
True. I don't think you'll find too many of those.
No, but I think that's a good choice because you don't have many.
Oh, well, that's really great because I love the design of them, and I just can't help keep thinking about them because I know I could get another Subaru or something, and they're a lot more plentiful, as you've suggested.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I just love the way the Jettas look.
No, they're a good car. I wouldn't be afraid to get it.
Well, Judy, good luck. Thank you very much, and let's go over to, another Judy. Judy, you're up. There's two in a row. Washington.
And my question is similar, only I am really just insistent on getting great gas mileage because I've had this sweetheart of a car, a 2000 Honda Insight, and it started out getting 68 miles to the gallon, and now at 13 years old, it's 54 miles to the gallon. But I've gone through what other callers, you know, just lots of repairs, and the recent this transmission went, and they really suggested I not repair it. I am repairing it, but I have to be prepared. There's nothing out there. For 30 years, I've had at least 45 miles to the gallon, and now I've got to go down from 50 to 70 to what? What have you got?
I tell you, there are some diesel vehicles now that are providing fantastic economy.
Yeah.
And back to the previous caller, Volkswagen Jetta.
Yeah.
Makes a clean diesel.
Yeah.
It's a very good sized car. You're not cramped like you are in, you know, your Insight's a very, very small car.
Yeah,
it's like being in a little teardrop.
Well, I've been able to haul all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. So if you want great economy and you are not looking to either get a hybrid, and some of the hybrids are not giving the economy that people think they are.
Yeah.
Look into a VW clean diesel.
Uh-huh. What makes them clean?
The technology of the engine design has made them so they don't smoke anymore, they don't smell, they start well, they don't even make diesel noises anymore.
Okay.
Well, I had a Rabbit, two cars before this, and it got 45 miles to the gallon, and it was clean and didn't make noise.
Yeah.
Nice.
If you like that Rabbit, going to the new Jettas of today is going to be light years ahead.
Okay. Let's go to Jim in Champlain. Jim, you're on real quick.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I've got a 1984 Plymouth Grand Fury with the 318 in it. And I've got a really bad hesitation, and I changed the carburetor, I've changed the ignition, I've changed the spark plugs and the wires, and if you give it any more than a feathering of gas when you start out, it just stalls on me.
Yeah, those were very tough years because emissions were really heavy duty, and those cars still had carburetors, which carburetors were okay in the day. You say you replaced it with a new or rebuilt unit or just a used one?
I put a brand new Edelbrock on it. I got an MSD ignition, and it hasn't changed the way it runs at all. It stalls right out. If you get up past the stall point, it runs fine. You know what I mean? That middle point.
Okay. We only got about 30 seconds here, Gordon.
Yeah. Pay close attention to the accelerator pump in that carburetor. Make sure it's shooting a good solid stream of gas as you depress the throttle.
How would you check that?
Look right down the holes in the carburetor.
Okay.
And if that is giving you a good solid stream, then it's probably not a fuel issue and you need to look elsewhere. And that could be in a variety of spots.
Well, Jim, good luck with that. We appreciate your call and thanks again to everybody who called in. Here's one last one from Facebook. Gene on Facebook says, my heat shield rusted off from near the muffler. I was told it didn't matter and didn't worry about it. What say you?
Well, it's a touchy question because those heat shields are on there for a couple of reasons.
Yeah.
The ones on the top of the converter, the catalytic converter and the exhaust, are to keep the high temperatures of the catalytic converter from baking the floor of the car. And in extreme cases, if the converter ran into trouble and overheated, you don't want the car catching on fire.
No, that wouldn't be good.
No. The shields on the bottom are more there to protect grass and fields and leaves under the car.
Okay.
So if I had to live without one of them, I would live without the one on the bottom.
All right.
But I would be a little bit hesitant on not having anything on top of the converter. Because now you're into the floor of the car. It might have undercoating or wax coating.
Sure.
The carpet's under there. That's the one I'd be a little more concerned with.
All right. And thanks to everybody who called in today. Support comes from Curran Compliance Services, LLC, Greenwich, New York. Legal and consulting services on regulatory issues for life insurance and annuity manufacturers and distributors. CurranCompliance.com. New York State Canal Corporation, featuring the journey of the replica canal schooner Lois McClure through the Erie Canal this summer. Cruise the past, unlock the adventure, canals.ny.gov. Berkshire Health Systems, working to improve the health of people in the Berkshires and surrounding communities, berkshirehealthsystems.org. And Berkshire Museum Pittsfield Paperworks, the art and science of an extraordinary material, featuring works of art in paper by more than 35 contemporary artists, plus historic objects and artifacts, berkshiremuseum.org. Thanks to Zach Malloy for the sterling service at the controls. Also, thanks to Brandon for answering the phones today. Thanks, as always, to Gordon Fricke of Barber and Fricke Automotive in Hoosick, New York. Great show. Thanks to everybody for calling in. Tomorrow, it's Moyers & Company. Next week, Medical Monday with orthopedist Dr. Fred Fletcher. Stay tuned for a news update.